right, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Serious Angler Podcast, presented by our friends over at X2 Power Batteries. And I am flying solo tonight. I'm your host, Bailey Eigbrett. And unfortunately, Andy is a little bit under the weather. He's been battling something. As you guys know, we tease Andy a little bit that his house, for whatever reason, might be the sickest in America. It seems like every day, Deacon and I get a text that either he's sick, Amanda's sick, his kids are sick, somebody's sick with something crazy. But he's just not feeling too well. He wanted to be here tonight, but you know, when Andy can't trooper through for an episode, he's definitely down and out with something that's not too good. So obviously hope he feels better so he can get back to the shows, but at least he made it for Fantasy Fishing last night. If you guys have not checked that out, that was a really fun episode. First one of the year with the crew. And I don't know if you guys saw, but Justin Largen, the host of Kayak Fishing Weekly here on the Serious Angler Podcast Network, he's joining us as well. So the group has expanded for 2024 for Fantasy Fishing. But it was a lot of fun, a lot of laughs. As always with that crew, we like to talk crap and have a good time. So if you guys haven't checked it out and you're playing Fantasy Fishing, I encourage you to go listen or watch that show from last night. But tonight we are back with a great episode and a great friend, Mr. Stephen Barden, fisheries biologist, who comes out and drops some real knowledge on us. And he's got some pretty cool things from the first Major League Fishing BPT event that he's going to show us. And of course, we're going to catch up with him too. He's got some big plans coming up for the year with what he's got going on in his neck of the woods, as well as with Major League Fishing and leading the way in regards to fishing conservation. So it's always a good conversation with Steve. But before we get into that, real quick, guys, tonight's show, it's only going to be on one parter. We're not going to have the two different parts for this week, so there will be no episode on Friday. So apologies for that, but we're just going to have one episode for this week. But that being said, you have to look forward to Kayak Fishing Weekly, of course, if you're into the kayak side of things. And then, of course, on Saturday, there's always the Lure Lab, which, well, Andy's chilling in the comments with the Lure Lab. Nonetheless, yeah, as people are saying, get well soon, Captain. We are captainless tonight. You got episodes, though, is what I'm trying to say is while we won't have an episode of Serious Angler on Friday, you can still have other shows on the network that you can go check out. If you haven't checked out our other shows, you're new to Serious Angler, our description for YouTube as well as MP3, you can always go down and browse what else we got going on at the podcast network, because we have a lot happening and a lot that is on the horizon. So it's cool to see the growth nonetheless. Right now I'm at Lake Murray. I don't know if you guys didn't tune in last night, you guys can obviously see, like, hey, you're not in your basement. This is a different background. I'm at Lake Murray here in South Carolina. I'm here with Justin Largen. We're fishing the Bassmaster kayak event this coming weekend. I worked yesterday and today, so I didn't get the opportunity to get on the water. So tomorrow through Friday, I get to go fishing all day, which I'm pretty pumped. I went this past weekend on my way down here, but it's the first full day of fishing in 2024. So I'm pretty psyched to do so and go and film. And Chasing Hardware, if you guys tune into my personal YouTube channel, it's already being filmed and underway. Episode one is already done. We're in the editing stages trying to get that out for you guys. But before we get Steve on here, make sure you guys tune in for more updates through Lake Murray. We're going to have, of course, show. We'll recap all that next week. I'm sure on Kayak Fishing Weekly as well, Justin, as we're both fishing the same event. We were just talking a little bit offline, but Major League Fishing BPT started today. I feel bad. I didn't even realize day one was happening. And I think that is partly due to the fact that they are not live streaming, at least the first. Was it the first 2 days they're not live stream? Something like that. But started today at Santee Cooper. And shocker, Mr. Matt Becker is off to another lead with 45 pounds, 8 ounces, with his big bass being a 6'10". And Steve's actually got some data on this. We'll bring him here in a second. But, of course, Becker off to a great start. Dude's a freaking hammer. And rounding out the top five, we got Dylan Hayes, Alton Jones Jr., James Watson, who recently posted and created some buzz. Gerald's four and Dustin Connell leading in six. So it's rather tight there, at least in the top 10. Like, people can make moves, especially for the fish that are in Santee Cooper. But without further ado, before I start talking more about the PPT, let's get on the man himself, man of the night, Mr. Stephen Barden. What's going on, sir?
What's up, Bailey? How are you, brother?
I'm good, man.
I'm good. I'm so sad. So sad Andy's not here.
I know. I know. We don't get anybody to make fun of.
We'll still make fun of him. I just finished watching on the playback crew last night's episode. I want to put in Ben Milliken for Rookie of the Year. Oh. And I think Jordan Lee for Angler of the Year.
Really? You think Joe Lee's first year back? AOI.
Well, right? Here's the thing. I watch these guys on BPT stuff and team series and cups and those things. And the one thing that I feel like the Bass Pro Tour does for an angler is really polishes their actual fish catch ability, as in they don't lose as many fish at the boat because they have to have every single one of them. So I think you see that, like when Pollinate jumped back over, Jason Christie jumped back over, you see those guys, they don't lose many fish. And I think with Jordan, when he was so dominant in Bassmaster, he was young and he just has this great instinct to never, you know, he knows where to be at the last second. But now I think he's polished his game quite a bit. He doesn't lose many fish. He was always in the running for the BPT Angler of the Year. So, yeah, I think first year back, he's got it.
I'm not going to say no to that. I mean, it's Jordan Lee. I mean,
it's Jordan Lee. I mean, he might as well win them all.
I think the dude has shown he can win just about anywhere.
Anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be cool to see the dynamic of it, of him coming back. Absolutely. Class coming in. There's a lot of cool stories this year, at least on the Elite Series side. But you mentioned offline, you actually, so day one of the BPT started today. You had some data on some of the fish caught.
Oh, yeah. We want to do that.
Let's dive into the bulk of today.
Okay. Let's pull it up. Sorry. I closed it, Bailey.
You're good.
We were looking at it, guys. I'm so sorry. I've got like the back end of the score tracker. So it comes to like a website, right? And I've got like the back end. I click it and look at all the stats. So Santee Cooper showing out to the score tracker. We've got, we had 9 fish over, we had 9 6-pounders, 3 over 7, and 1 over 8. So those 3 sevens and that 1 8, we'll get a DNA sample from those fish. We've got our DNA swabs on the boats this year. So we'll be able to do some DNA work, figure out what those fish are. And whenever I set the minimum on this, I set it as a 1 8, because looking at the electrofishing data, it looked like it's going to be pretty rough. And the catch count shows 219 fish for the day, which is lower than average. So I'm really glad we set it at 1 pound, 8 ounce. That's 32 additional fish that we had this event that if we had a 2 pound minimum, we wouldn't have had. And you guys know 32 fish, you divide that by 80 guys, like that might be the difference in somebody getting Angler of the Year points or not, is those 32 fish. So it'd be cool to see how that event plays out. Of course, every fish caught today was a largemouth. New for this year, I don't know. We haven't really ever showed all the data we collect, and that's kind of what we're going to go into tonight. But new for this year, I'm also tracking if fish were caught with forward-facing sonar or not. It's going to be a really interesting year.
So really fast, we're going to unpack all this because the no forward or with forward is actually super intriguing. But we've had you on several times on this show. And I don't think since the first one, we reinforced your position, like what you do with Major League Fishing, like what your role is. Okay. Like, can you quickly like go through for some people that might have not seen or heard the episode, like what your role is, what you do with all this data?
Well, shame on them. They should go back and watch them all, right? No, that's a great question. That's where we should have started. You're right, Bailey. So I'm a fisheries biologist. I grew up in the private sector. I've never worked for a state agency. In about, 7-8 years ago, I texted Gary Klein, who's a good friend and client of mine. And I said, you know, what you guys are doing in, on these cups that I'm watching on Outdoor Channel is a lot like what I do every day with electrofishing boat. You're collecting data. And what you could do, and I started listing out all these things that they could be doing. And turns out they were doing a lot of it internally. They were collecting things like the depth that the fish were caught in, the types of habitat. Like, they were collecting all this data. And so I pitched Major League Fishing on this idea that we could do a lot. We could share a lot of this data with the states. And over time, that has morphed into a consulting position for myself. So I'm technically the director of the Major League Fishing Fisheries Management Division. Kind of the role is it's dependent on what we're doing at each event. First and foremost, at the beginning of the season, when the planning's happening, and beginning of our season is like July, August, is when we're planning and putting schedule together and finalizing all the details of the next season. So what I'm doing is I'm working with the state agencies where we're going to potentially compete and getting their electrofishing data, running it through some these formulas that I've created that look at like what size is a legal bass in that fishery. And then what is the average at each 1 pound weight increment. And then I make a recommendation to our angler competition committee on what the minimum scoreable weight is. And then at each event, if we have like an activation on our conservation side, then I work with the state agencies to fulfill some sort of conservation project. It might be a habitat project, a trash cleanup, a vegetation restoration, fish sampling of some sorts. We've done some really cool things with universities where we look at, do fish have largemouth bass virus and some things like that. So I get to facilitate those during the events. And then after the event, I collect all the data, and my staff and I put it into this really cool spreadsheet that we're going to share tonight. I'm going to kind of show the world what we provide everybody's state agency. And we do this, you know, Bailey, this whole thing works with partnerships. So like our habitat projects, that's in a partnership with Minn Kota. This data that you're going to see tonight is in partnership with Berkeley Labs and Mossy Oak. So it's really cool because we get to bring scientists and anglers and industry together and create partnerships and really create impactful things that make our fisheries better. So that's kind of my job in a short summary.
Yeah. You're fighting the good fight, basically.
Yeah, we're trying. We're trying.
Hey, somebody's got to lead the way. I'm glad it's you. Because the data you get, like literally what you're about to see, the one you explained to me what I was looking at, I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, we'll have to, we're going to have to share a screen. We're going to have to show everybody what we collect. And it's been filtered down. I mean, I can't show you everything that I have. Because I could, like, it is so, the data set is so big that I could go back all the way to Lake Amistad. That was the first Major League Fishing Cup. That would have been 13 years ago now. I can go back to that event, and I could tell you what Brent Ayler caught his first fish on, the depth that that fish was caught in, what it weighed, the type of habitat that it was around, who his official was, what time it was, the GPS exact location of that fish. I can tell you that for every fish caught ever in a Major League Fishing catch, weigh, and release event.
So how was that recorded? Is like there legitimately a marshal that recorded the weight and said Brent Ayler, Nico Rig? Like that's...
Yep, that's exactly what happened. So you've wow. If you've watched the Bass Pro Tour, you've seen the angler catches the fish. They bring it on. This year we have the Bubba scale, and the Bubba scale does a little bit of this internally for us. But the angler unhooks the fish, approaches the official, and the official originally was like a volunteer. Then for a while they traveled with the league all around the country, and now they're like regional officials. But the official is trained by MLF to hold the scale in a specific way so that it gets a completely accurate reading. And you watch the digital scale until it locks. And then the official, if you've ever noticed, will say the weight out loud, and they will be very specific with what they say. So they would say like Bailey, 2 pounds, 2 ounces scoreable bass, or Bailey scoreable bass, 2 pounds, 2 ounces.
Right.
And then the angler typically will verbally agree or disagree. And that could happen up to 3 times. Like, they can go back and forth 3 times, remove the fish, reweigh the fish, remove the fish, reweigh the fish. That's in our rules. And then the angler can actually ask for the official to pull another scale out. There's always 2 duplicate scales on the boat, and they can reweigh that fish. If for some reason the angler reweighs the fish, it is whatever the last weight was, not the highest weight of all the times you weighed it. So you may lose an ounce or two as that fish dries off. Our fish average 24 seconds out of water time. So most of the fish are weighed quickly. The angler agrees with the official and they get it back in the water. And what you don't see is that official sits down, in the passenger seat, pulls out a paper log and writes the weight down. Then they pull out an iPad and they open the score tracker, and the score tracker looks very different for us. It's got a lot of drop-down menus, things like that. So they input that fish, and then it has questions. So the official is assigned an angler. So let's say you're my angler, I'm your official. So I would click in, Bailey, I would input the weight. You caught a 2 pound, 2 ounce fish. The next thing it would ask me is, what fish species was this? Was this a largemouth, smallmouth, or spotted bass? Then it would ask me what type of bait, and it gives like a drop-down menu of the different bait categories. Then it would ask me, what area of the lake are we in? Are we like midwater? Are we in a bay? Are we up in a river? Where are we at? Then it would ask me the type of cover that we're fishing. So do I see standing timber? Do I see submerged vegetation? Am I out in open water? Then it would ask me in 5 foot increments, what depth are we in? And so the official is using the depth finder to make these references. They're looking at what is happening on the boat. So there is some interpretation, right? There's some interpretation by the official. You may not have thrown exactly at that piece of standing timber, but you're fishing around standing timber. So then the last question that's new for this year is, was forward-facing sonar used? And it's just a yes or no. It's not like to the point where we're asking, like, was the fish found with forward-facing sonar? Did they cast at a fish that they observed? Were they using it in the process? Yes or no. And then they press enter, and the iPad itself gives it a time, a date, in the latitude, longitude, so a GPS location where it was inputted. That comes to headquarters, and anybody who has access to it can then go into the backside of it, and we can see the data, and then we press enter, and it now is on the live stream.
That is wicked. These marshals are earning their keep, man.
They are. And you got to realize, the angler, like, if you want a Bass Pro Tour event, the maximum you fished is 7.5 hours a day for 4 days. But the official was on the water for 7.5 hours, 6 days in a row, because they don't get an off day. Yeah. So the official is really the hero. They have a big training that they have to do before every single event. And there's some other things. I have in the rule book the ability for an angler to live well a fish if it's an exceptional fish. So let's say, you're on Toledo Bend and for some reason you catch a fish over 18 pounds. Well, that would be a new lake record and a new state record. So you could live well that fish so that we could catalog that fish. If it's a sharelunker in the state of Texas, we can live well that fish and donate it to Texas Parks and Wildlife. The official also has the DNA swabs. We do this really cool thing where if a fish is caught that weighs over 7 pounds, we've got a mouth swab to where they scrub the tongue, and then those are actually collected by myself, and then I take them to Texas Parks and Wildlife starting this year, and they're going to run all the DNA for every fish caught across the United States over 7 pounds in a major league fishing competition. And we do the DNA swabs at lower levels and at the tackle warehouse as well. So if you ever fish like a BFL, if there's a live release boat at an MLF event you fish, yeah, we're taking DNA from any fish over 7 pounds that hits that boat.
So that's the mark, anything over 7.
Yeah, I set that mark because I wanted a universal mark that could work, you know, basically from Florida to New York. And we had a 7-pound fish caught, largemouth caught at Cayuga last year. So we know we're in the right zone. 7-pound is not necessarily a trophy in the southern United States, but we wanted to include the northern states in that. And we didn't want it to fluctuate as we move north.
Hey, don't make fun of our 7-pounders, okay? They're fish too.
they're great fish. They're exceptional. They're old fish. And you guys have, you know, you have double digit fish. They're really hard to find.
I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole because I'll talk your ear off for a good 30 minutes on where I think it's going to get caught. But I'll say this. I think it's going to get caught in the next 3 years.
Oh, I don't see why Cayuga can't produce one.
There's a few lakes that can definitely do it, now, especially now that they got gobies in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. With that process, I'm really curious now. Are you guys doing anything like specific to the smallmouth? Like when you guys go up to St. Lawrence or anything like that? Like, would you swab a smallmouth if it was over 7?
So the reason we swab to collect DNA is because we are looking at the difference in geographic location and trophy potential of Florida versus northern genetic largemouth. Those are two different species of fish. A Florida bass and a largemouth bass genetically are pretty far apart, actually. They're actually 3 times greater genetically different than a spotted bass and a smallmouth is. So a spotted bass and a smallmouth is closer in genetic relation than a largemouth and a Florida. So we're tracking... And truthfully, Bailey, we're trying to figure out, as part of a collective group of biologists, right? We want to know, where do Florida bass naturally occur? Where have they been introduced? And then most agencies are worried about total population genetics. So what percentage of the population has Florida genetics? In Major League Fishing, we're kind of going at it the opposite direction. We're saying, the population is the population. What about the exceptional individuals in the population? Is there a genetic that maybe produces a better quality fish, although less of them for whatever reason? So we specifically focus on largemouth because of that Florida dynamic. Whenever you talk about smallmouth, there are 3 species of smallmouth bass that live in the United States. The main one, northern smallmouth, is what 99.9% of smallmouth are. There's only 2 river drainages that have different lineages of smallmouth. So we're not concerned necessarily like what type of smallmouth did you catch, because you caught a northern smallmouth. So understanding the genetics just from that component isn't important. Now, there is research coming out of Georgia from a private fish hatchery and concurrently coming from Texas Parks and Wildlife with the ShareLunker program that does show some ability to predict trophy growth based on genetics. Like there's up to 3 genetic markers that could predict trophy growth, especially in a Florida largemouth bass. So there would be some benefit if, I don't know if it would be economically important, but there would be some benefit into taking samples of large smallmouth and seeing if we can correlate a growth indicator in their genetic markers. Then what? You know, truthfully, smallmouth in the northern United States, they don't have to be managed in the same way that largemouth do. You have a shorter growing season that allows longer lifespans. You have protection because you have closed seasons, even if it's just due to ice. And you have abundance of benthic forage like gobies now, crayfish, things like that smallmouth can consume. With low energy output. They don't have to chase shad or mullet or anything like that, like a lot of your largemouth and your spotted bass do.
Total off topic here, but with our smallmouth, from your knowledge, if New York put a slot limit on smallmouth, similar to say like the Tennessee River, what do you think that would do for the state? Like, do you think that size will blow up, or it's just maybe less the way, I mean, the biggest thing I see with it is less smaller fish that are being taken to weigh-ins that aren't going to do any good for anybody.
Yeah. I mean, we have to look at what is a regulation for. You know, a harvest regulation across most of the country is built so that we can get fish to a catchable legal size for harvest. So they're designed to grow fish to 14, 15, 16 inches, where now they're desirable by somebody to eat, and then that fish can be removed from the system. If you do that correctly, you can actually skew a population to a larger size because you reduce the amount of competition as fish are small and resources are harder to come by. And then the ones that are left in the system can grow to a larger size. The issue is we don't, as a bass fishing community, we don't harvest at a meaningful rate in most states now. And truthfully, smallmouth are the same way. There's probably more smallmouth consumed by walleye guides than there are bass fishermen, right? Mm. So we have an incidental mortality whenever we have a weigh-in, but that skews towards the larger fish. So truthfully, if I was designing a regulation, and this would never happen, but if I was designing one, trying to improve the overall size, create more trophy smallmouth, what I would do is I would probably start to allow harvest at 10 to 12 inches, and then I would stop allowing harvest at about 14 to 15 inches. There'd be a very narrow window of harvest where the majority of the 1 to 2 year old fish would live, and we could pull those out. And then the ones that escape that harvest, they would be able to grow for the next, you know, 12 to 20 years and become trophy fish. That's the hardest part about y'all's fish is they need 2 decades basically of great conditions to grow to a trophy size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How old do you think that 10 pounder in Lake Erie was?
I would give it probably 14 or 15 at least, maybe 18. I mean, it's hard. It's so hard to tell because the growth rates, you got to look at optimal growing days. You got to look at forage consumption. You got to look at things like, you know, stress, and stress can come from angling activity. Stress can come from just environmental activities. So it's almost impossible to predict the age of a fish. It's actually even hard to age a fish. You know, if once you have that fish, if it has died or you have it in your possession, it's, you got to look at hard structures like the spines. You can cut the dorsal spines off of a fish and then slice them and look at them under a viewing scope and see if they have like rings like a tree would have. Mm. But they're not, it's not 100% accurate. The most accurate way to do it is actually a bone that lives, it sits right behind the brain of a fish. It's called an otolith. They're inner ear bones. So the most accurate way to age a fish is to take the inner ear bone out, crack it in half, polish it, and look at under microscope with, or under magnification with like a fiber light or something like that. Then you can read the rings. But, you know, then you really are, whoever's the viewer kind of skews the reading of those otoliths. So a lot of times the older a fish is, the closer the rings are getting, it really becomes difficult to accurately age them.
Yeah. So I guess basically the only way to truly accurately age them would be put a tracker on them as they're a yearling. And
yeah, we do, especially in the private sector, we do a lot of pit tags. Like, do you have a dog that has a microchip?
No, but I know of people that do it.
Yeah, we do that with fish.
That's cool.
So then you're tracking individuals. That is a very accurate way. And I did a couple social media posts the last couple of weeks on some fish that we've been tracking for years, looking at their growth, and it's amazing. I mean, because I posted a picture of 2 fish that came out of the same pond, 4-acre pond last week. I'm going to mess the numbers up, but basically over the last 3 years, we've been tracking these fish, and one of the fish has grown like 5 pounds and the other one's grown 1 pound. They're in the exact same environment with the exact same forage. One of them happens to be a male, the smaller one, and the other a female. So there's some sexual dimorphism that's occurring there where that's just how the cookie crumbles for males. They grow slower. They put a lot more effort into spawning than females do. One of them happens to, well, they both are F1 largemouth. So they're Florida Northern Crosses. And I bet if we looked at the genetics now, we could probably find that Florida marker for growth in one of them, and the other one's probably lacking it. But it's a lot of it is environmental. But sometimes whenever you make everything environmental perfect, then you can see genetics. And it's really fun, Bailey, to build these projects where we're talking about tracking individual fish. You get to know them. You get to know their home range, where you're going to catch them, whether it's as an angler or an electrofishing. It's a really, really number one important part of science, but actually a pretty rewarding part too.
That's so freaking cool. I love to shadow you for a couple of days. Come on. Stuff like this. I love to
do during it. When it's icy, right? Just come on down.
Yeah, might as well. Well, dude, I could keep going on this for hours, but I really want to dig into the stuff that you shared with me.
Let's talk about Toledo Bend. I think it's a relevant time, right? You've got Bassmaster that's going to be on Toledo Bend this week. Toledo Bend, the Bass Pro Tour, man, they showcased that fishery. It was pretty impressive, some of the things that the guys put together. So I also wanted to let you be the guy that helped me show the world what Major League Fishing does with their state agency. So this data, it actually went live to both Texas Parks and Wildlife and Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fish today. So they got an email that said, it's in the shared drive. Everything's finished. It's polished up. Take a look.
So we're about to drop some juice on this show is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I hope so.
So which link am I pulling up first?
I think we should do the boring spreadsheet first.
Boring spreadsheet coming in hot.
What do you think? Everybody loves spreadsheets. If I was at home right now, tuning into Serious Angler, I'm like, I just hope we get to look at a spreadsheet.
I just want to see a spreadsheet.
That's all I want to do. That's all I want to do. So first of all, just so we can kind of orient ourselves, this is if you work for a state agency and you had an event, a Bass Pro Tour, a team series event, anything that's catch, weigh, and immediate release by MLF, at the end of that event, this is what you're going to get. It's in like a shared folder, so this can't be accessed by just anybody. It's lock and key with like specific email addresses that can open it. What you see about. Yeah. I gave you permission on this one.
That's right.
We'll revoke it. I don't want to get you in trouble for information sharing.
Yeah, you're good.
So at the bottom, you see day 1 through 6. You can click one of those if you want, Bailey.
Okay, let's go.
It doesn't matter which one.
Go day 2.
Day 2. So this is literally, it's in reverse order. So, right?
Like that's the waypoints on this thing.
That's okay.
Oh, that's awesome.
We're going to do it quick. So it's in reverse order. That's the last fish caught of the day. But you see, I take a lot of the information that would be relevant to the actual fish catch off. And it's just leaving the information that would be important to a biologist, right? So the species, the fish, the area it was caught, the cover, the lat and the long, weight. And then we convert weight because bass fishermen, we use pounds and ounces. But in science, we don't do that. We use whole pounds or we use grams, kilograms, things like that. So that's on there. Then the depth range, forward facing, and the time. All right, now click back to that data tracker. Get off this, Bailey. What are you doing? I'm going to have to revoke. You're going to have to revoke your access immediately.
All right. So where am I going from here?
Let's start in that first box under the MLF logo. Just blow that up a little bit. Let's make that a little bigger.
Got you. You tell me when.
I'm getting old. That's great. Everybody can see that.
All right.
So this statistical analysis that I put together is what I would want to know if I was managing the lake, right? Like I just built what I thought would be cool for myself to provide to the agencies. Bailey has broken the system.
There. StreamYard hated me for a second.
StreamYard's like, man, we're doing too much. This is after hours.
Too much info.
Yeah. Boyd, shut us down.
Yeah, I think so.
No. So I broke it down how I would want data broken down. So if we just look at day 1, the total catch for the day is 354 fish. You could definitely find that out if you just looked at Score Tracker and and you counted the fish or whatever, you could find this. Mm-hmm. But we break it down really quickly. It's important to know that the BPT has changed over the years, if you didn't know, and the number of anglers that compete per day changes throughout an event and changes seasonality. So every year I have to kind of rewrite these formulas just a little bit. This year we're competing where 40 anglers would compete day one and day three. Another 40 anglers would compete day two and day four. And then the top 10 from each one of those groups, group A and B, meet on day five. So we only have 20 anglers on day five, and then we have 10 anglers on day six. So we know we have a decreasing number of anglers every day, so we should expect fish catches to decrease as well every day. Mm-hmm. So then what I like to do is look at, if I'm looking at a daily catch rate and I've got 354 fish and I have 40 anglers, well, how many fish did each angler average? I don't literally want to know, like, how many fish did Jacob Wheeler catch compared to whoever else. I want to know what's the average. Because what you're trying to do in fisheries management is create a copy of what a day would look like, right? If you are one of the top anglers in the world, what do I expect you to do if you go and fish this for one day? So what we see is that the average fish catch per angler is 8.85 on day one. And this fluctuates. Every single one of these I've ever looked at, there's no way to predict if that number is going to hold all week. And we see it in this data as well. Some of that fluctuation is due to the format and the angler's ability to let off the gas a little bit. And some of that is just due to time of year, weather conditions, things like that. I also divide it out into average fish per hour, because one of the main indicators in fisheries management is what we call catch per unit effort. If Bailey was going to go fish for 4 hours a day, how many fish could I expect Bailey to catch? Bailey has a number in his head that he would like to catch. And so if I interviewed Bailey at the end of the day in a krill survey, I said, Bailey, how long did you fish? How many fish did you catch? And your number and my number match, I'm doing a great job for you as an individual angler. And unfortunately, fisheries management is not built around individual anglers. It's built around a collective whole. So there's people like Bailey that want to catch 35, I'm guessing, an hour.
At least.
And then there's guys like me, and it's like, well, maybe if we could grind out six or seven a day, it'd be a good day. You know, I'm not a kayak world champion, though. So that's the difference. So we look at it as the total group. So we have 40 guys. They're competing for a known set of time. I think this is one thing that is underestimated by our fishing community, but it's so important, is that the Bass Pro Tour is the first organization that you have a confined maximum allotted time to fish. Because we know we have anglers that have a ride around period and they don't have a weigh-in to go to. So we know that they compete for three periods at 2.5 hours each. So they get 7.5 hours of competition time. So I can say as a known fact that no angler was able to compete for longer than 7.5 hours. And every one of them had the opportunity to do 7.5 hours. So it allows me to do an average fish per hour or catch per unit effort. I do also collect things like total weight in pounds, average weight of the individual fish, and then, of course, the largest fish every day. So I tally those up for every single day, and then, of course, the total for the events. And if you look at, like, the Toledo Bend event and knowing that we're going to crown a champion on day six, it's usually a pretty big trend that the number of fish per angler is always the highest on championship day, because nobody lets a fish go, right? Like, everybody grinds all day long. So although the total day catch, 194, is lower, you have to remember that's only 10 guys doing it. So they had an average of 19.4 fish per angler. That's pretty dang impressive.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. So total for the Toledo Bend event, we had 1,796 fish caught, 5,409.94 pounds, so 5'4", 10 in pounds. That's a lot of pounds. And the average weight, 3.02. The minimum was 2 pounds. If we put pound and a half fish back in this, we would drive that average down quite a bit. So yeah, you can scroll down, Bailey, if you want. This is just showing you how my mind works. Next, I want to know, I start with half pound increments, like 1.5 to 2 pounds, 2 to 2.5, 2.5 to 3 pounds. And that's the total number of fish that fall into that weight category that was caught each day. So I start breaking it down and looking at like, yeah, but okay, how maybe I know there's one 11 pound fish, but how many fish did I have over 7 pounds? You know, those are the questions I want to start asking myself. So that's why I built this calculator to where I could actually see it and provide it to the state agencies. There's no agency that's going to say, well, we want Toledo Bend to have more 8 pound fish. Like, how do we do that? And work that granularly, that specific. But across the state, we want more fish that are large. So this is kind of one of those indicators. As we go back to fisheries, we can compare them year in and year out.
So we have a question here that says, he's asking, do you record physical environmental data during those days of the tournament?
We do, yeah. I do things like air temp, moon phase, of course, seasonal conditions, if we have a front that came in or not. I try to provide some of that information to the agency. Then again, it's over a week's time, so most of our events are so variable. You've been to them, Bailey. It's like if a professional tournament comes to a town, you're going to have every weather condition you could possibly have that week.
It's never nice.
Yeah, it's – well, you get one day that's nice.
Well, yeah, one out of the six for Major League Fishing.
One day.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's go back up to the top and then over to the middle. Oh, wait. Maybe there's something else down there. Go down. Let's see what's down there. You can skip that. That's just percentage of the population. It gets hard to read.
Depth range is cool.
Yeah, we have depth range. So I think this is always curious, especially now that we talk a lot more about forward-facing sonar, and these numbers have changed quite a bit since forward-facing sonar came out. But the number of fish that are caught offshore versus inshore is always interesting to me. And Toledo Bend was, I would say, fairly split, right? You know, if we're talking about fish that were under 5 foot, we had 500. And if we talk fish that were over 20 foot, 547. Like, that's a pretty even split. The majority were caught between that range. So we had fish kind of throughout the week that were caught at various ranges. And if you keep going down, I do make some graphs that we provide the states as well. So we can see maybe did something that was happening in a weather weather actually trend throughout the week. Uh-huh. You know, are we seeing fish that are moving up to spawn during a spawning event? We're seeing fish that are moving out during a post-spawn event. So we have that kind of graphically there for them as well.
Nice. Yeah. Go back up top?
Yeah, let's go to the middle.
Middle? Up top in the middle? Or
Top middle. This isn't as relevant in an event like Toledo Bend, but let's say we were at Cayuga. Let's say we're somewhere in the Great Lakes. We start talking about the breakdown between largemouth and smallmouth. I do track that every single day. So that graph is super boring because it's just mainly largemouth. So you can keep scrolling down. If you have questions, Bailey, just throw them out there, man.
I'm just mesmerized. So growing up, quick fact, I was such an analytical kid when it came to, I was a hockey nut, still am. And I would literally, for fun, I can't believe I'm actually saying this. As a kid, I would straight up record Excel sheets of my favorite hockey players, their time on ice, assists, points, player average, all that stuff. I did that for fun. It's like, this stuff is mesmerizing to me because, one, obviously it's fishing. Two, like, some of this data you can learn from is actually pretty cool.
Absolutely.
Like, if I'm a tournament angler, I'm looking at this, not even just because it's Toledo Bend, but just in general, seeing the trending that's happening. Right. That this is really freaking cool.
That's exactly right. And you see also as a tournament angler, like, let's put yourself back in the Bass Pro Tour. As a tournament angler, this is a lot of data, right? Yeah. At the same time, it protects you so much because I could not pinpoint one of these fish, you know, these 1,700 or almost 1,800 fish and say, well, that was Bailey's fish. You know, the only one you could maybe talk about is like the 11-pound fish becomes pretty obvious. You know, that's a Cliff Crochet fish. We know that because it's the only one. But for the most part, it's almost impossible to find an individual fish in the data set.
That's freaking cool.
Yeah. All right. So we also break it down by pounds. This is, once again, in a northern event, this becomes super relevant. Maybe at Del Hollow this year, this is going to be very relevant. How many pounds of largemouth, smallmouth spots are weighed every single day?
That would be super cool to see what KU got last year.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I've got it. I've got it for multiple years, but yeah, you can't. If you've got a tournament there, I can't give it to you. I don't want you to get DQ.
In general, like when they went to like oh no, they were Mille Lacs. There wasn't that much largemouth caught. But like a general fishery that does have a as 50-50 as you can get. I feel like just seeing this data would be just very intriguing. Lake name aside, I just like to see how that mixes. It's kind of cool.
It can give you the confidence. You got to remember though, and this is where anglers probably get a little maybe too excited about this kind of data, is that this is a snapshot of something that happened in the past. Mm-hmm. We can't replicate this week. You know, there's no possible way for us to give you these exact conditions and have you have this same thing happen. So right. this might dial you in a little bit. You know, should I chase the largemouth? Should I chase smallmouth? But week to week, month to month, those things are going to change.
Yeah, I think it'd just be cool to take some different fisheries and just see
what's
the trend. Yeah,
you haven't seen anything yet. It's about to get really cool.
Scroll down.
Yeah, let's go down. We'll get one more boring one out of the way, and then we'll see the cool stuff. For me, yeah, we can stop right here, Bailey. For me, also, this goes back to moon phase and like feeding times, and I think it's super cool because we know that there's major and minor feeds every day. We all have apps that predict when we should fish, and for the most part, our data. If I plug this in to a moon phase and start looking at when the moon phase, like we can see some of those trends. Throughout an event, and it's, I would say, greater than 50% of the time that they match up to either major or minor. So it's not perfect, but it certainly gives me that ability to even look at it. So this is just, I didn't explain it. This is every fish caught within that 1 hour group, and there are some, I don't do it in the spreadsheet, but there's an off period, right? So there's 15 minutes of it off twice in this day. So two of those are only actually 45 minute, where the rest are full hour.
And the day six, where there's a 5 to 5:59, that's because of the fog.
Right? Yeah, we had a fog delay that day. So I built the calculator to kind of be able to move up and down. This all self-populates. So like for the Sandy Cooper event, we have day one done. Well, if we pulled up the same chart, day one we would see it already. It self-populates.
That's cool.
Yep. All right, let's go up and right. I'm following along on my own.
Okay.
This is what gets me kind of excited about the data we collect is whenever the official puts in the habitat type that the fish was caught around. The reason it excites me as a biologist because this is something I can actually make an action item, right? Like let's say fish were caught on submerged vegetation continuously. Mm-hmm. There's the ability to then filter this data for all those fish and create a map of where the submerged vegetation is throughout the reservoir. There's also the ability to then say, if I increase submerged vegetation, would I increase catch rates or not? So this is really cool to me because it gives us the opportunity to look at habitat type. And it's, once again, it's an interpretation by the official. If we look at specifically Toledo Bend data, we see that the majority of fish were caught offshore, 848 throughout the entire event. So offshore, whenever they click it in this, Bailey, means there was no visual habitat type. It's not standing timber. It's not boat docks. It is, we're on nothing. We don't see rock piles on the depth finder. We are out in the middle of nowhere.
So could it be though, like if the angler isn't talking to the marshal, or does the marshal ask, like if they're offshore, say they're looking at live scope and there's a brush pile in front, obviously the marshal can't see that. Does the marshal ask, like, what are you specifically fishing? Or could it technically factor in?
They talk a lot. So most of the marshals are really, I mean, number one, they're anglers. So they're in tune with what's happening. A lot of the guys will put the forward facing on the rear depth finder so the official can watch what's happening as well. That's helpful. Or if they have like a 360 or something, they can see all the way around. So most of our marshals are, or officials is what we call them. Most of our officials are pretty intuitive, but they do talk. But at the end of the day, Bailey, this is still that official's interpretation of what happened. So right. You can't take it as gospel. May have been something subtle that they didn't see. But you know for sure, like you see a hump or you see brush pile on this list, you know if it's marked with one of those, they saw it. I mean, they had a reason to put that down.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So it makes it super cool. So I break those down into, you know, the percentage. We see, like, if we stop at offshore once again, we see 848 offshore fish. That feels like a big number, but it was actually 47%. So although it was the majority of the fish caught, it wasn't like, yes, that was the dominant pattern, but it wasn't like that was the only thing going on. And in fact, 53% of the time, people were somewhere else doing something different.
That's cool.
It's really cool. And vegetation played. If we combine vegetation mainly below the water, that's the second highest one, 233. Yeah, that's the second highest one. Only 12%, well, 13%, but that
could be offshore though, right?
That could be offshore, but you know that they saw the vegetation on the depth finder.
Got it. Okay. So that's something to note though, like looking at this is, it could be offshore, like an offshore brush pile, but it's getting factored into brush pile, correct?
Correct. Absolutely. Yep. And it also would be, you know, if I was fishing Toledo Bend this week, I might be looking for something like vegetation below the water.
Right.
Yep.
And I think one thing too, and I'm curious from your standpoint, like looking at this data, where when you look at it, it might be what, it could be also speaking to not just how the lake is setting up, but also it could be angler trend, like in regards to how anglers are fishing. Where just because, say, the majority are catching offshore doesn't mean you can't go catch them up shallow. It's just there's been the recent craze of one forward facing and technology in general. That's just how anglers are fishing now. That's absolutely what this could speak to versus just this is how the lake is setting up.
Yeah, what I'm looking at specifically this year is as we take in forward-facing sonar as one of our categories. Now I'm dividing the data into buckets. And I can then go back if I can find trends. So let's say, like, we collect bait category as well. So let's say internally I sat down and I look at jerk bait. And I'm like, oh, jerk bait all of a sudden is 85% of the fish caught. And 90% of the time when a jerkbait is used, it's now used with forward-facing sonar. I can then go back to previous seasons and watch that trend as it emerges and then predict how many people were utilizing forward-facing sonar at what rate in the past seasons. There will be some things like that I'll be able to come up with before the end of this year for sure.
Pretty cool.
So let's scroll to the right some more.
To the right, okay.
Yeah, let's go look at forward-facing sonar. Everybody thinks that forward-facing sonar is the deal, that, you know, all these guys are doing it. And we see that Toledo Bend, yeah, I mean, it was the majority of fish were caught with forward-facing sonar, especially championship day, 95.88% of those fish were caught with forward-facing sonar technologies. So it seems like the beginning of the week was lower and it trended up all week long as that just became the most apparent productive way to catch fish, right?
That's incredible.
That's incredible. Keep scrolling down though. It gets a little cooler. So I then write a more complex formula. And what this formula does is it says count a fish in 1 pound increments, basically. If it was caught with forward facing sonar, and then the chart below is if it was caught without forward facing sonar. So now we can start looking at size classes of fish. And are you catching more fish that are a larger size because you have forward facing sonar or because you don't? And if you scroll to the bottom, Bailey, I've got a chart. Keep going. This compares them. So the red are forward-facing sonar fish. The blue is not. And here's the trend that we see. As size increases, the impact of forward-facing sonar is decreasing. So a lot of the smaller fish are being caught with forward-facing sonar. And then as we increase size, now this is the first event we're doing with this. So at the end of Sandy Cooper, I'm going to look at this again. At the end of Red Crest, I'm going to look at it again. And if I can start,
I'm going to title this show that says Stephen Barden, fisheries biologist, says if you use forward facing, you catch small fish. That's what I call it.
It's in the data, right? You see that's the truth is. As the fish size increases, of course, the abundance, so the sample size of fish that you have caught decreases, but also the difference in forward-facing sonar versus not is decreasing as well.
That's impressive.
Yeah, so we'll also correlate, like, if you look at that first line where we talk about 770 fish that were in that 2 pound, 2 to 3 pound class were caught with forward-facing sonar, I'll start weighting this graph to where I can look at the percentage difference at every size class. And once I look at the percentage difference, we'll really know how impactful forward-facing sonar is on these larger fish.
That's wicked cool, man.
Yeah. Love it. Wicked. So we provide that to your state agency. So when we start talking about MLF coming to town, you know, in showcasing a fishery and showcasing what it has, we provide this to your state so that we can help them understand and us understand what was actually occurring on that fishery at that time.
It's probably still in New York's inbox. They haven't opened it yet.
No comment. We do some other cool stuff. I don't know how long you wanted to go tonight, but I got time.
We'll be pulling up this map.
Yeah, let's talk about the map real quick. Because we have GPS location on every single fish catch, I can create really cool GIS maps that allow us to answer questions. You're going to have to zoom in quite a bit.
I just think. Why is this? Okay, there we go.
So I just gave you the points on Toledo Bend, and I kept the same color scheme that we had in the forward facing sonar. So red are forward facing fish, blue are not. And I mean, it becomes a pretty obvious trend that the majority of non forward facing sonar fish happen to be along the shoreline. But that's not always the case.
The one group. This was Keith Boucher.
Yeah, where'd he go? Yeah, that's either Keith or Ott. You can always find them. Like, it cracks me up because, like, some of the North Carolina lakes or Florida lakes, I will literally find somebody 3 miles, 4 miles down where there's not even water on the map anymore. And I'm like, that's Keith Boucher.
That's awesome. So when you were talking about earlier of like identifying certain fish from the data, you can identify those. Like
you can find Poche for sure. Awesome. So we make these maps to try to answer specific questions. Let's say you were a biologist,
marking waypoints.
Yeah, exactly. Just circle the bottom half of the lake. That's where you should go. Yeah. Let's say you're a biologist and you were wondering, like, where are smallmouth versus largemouth caught? Well, I could do that map. Like, I could make these points. If you want to just hover on a point, Bailey, it doesn't matter which one. Pick your favorite.
Let's go over here. Does that work?
Yeah, no. Pick a point. Just any of those red points.
Pick one. Pick like one of these dots. Okay. I thought you meant like a legit, like a point on the lake.
Yeah, that's a great point, too. We see a lot of fish. So if you click it, like we get the breakdown on what that fish was, right? 3.94, caught in 15 to 20 feet with forward-facing sonar. Hide it now, Bailey. Dang.
Sorry.
Man, I'm glad I'm not fishing Toledo Bend this week.
the timing of this.
Incredible. What was my point? My point was, if you're a biologist and you're like, let's say I'm at Cayuga and I want to know where smallmouth caught versus largemouth. Well, I could make you the same map. I could make the smallmouth one color, the largemouth another color, and then you could better predict where those fish will be found in the reservoir. Maybe if you have a lack of vegetation, we could make this same map and just say color and only submerged vegetation and see that. So we provide those to answer specific questions for the states. And none of this is public. We actually, we keep them under the email lock and key, you know, for a good reason. Bailey, your sound went out, just letting you know. It's that sound bar. Bailey is outside 40 degrees and a sound bar keeps literally freezing. It's getting too cold. So periodically, he's going to leave us. This makes really good podcast as well, because we know audio is the only thing you actually need in podcast. There you go, Bailey. You're back. Nope. All right, live chat. I guess it's time for you and me to have a conversation. Does anybody have a question? When Bailey is...
All right. Can you hear me right now?
We hear you.
I have it on my MacBook, at least right now.
Okay.
For the time being.
I was calling for questions. I was kicking you out.
Although I can't hear you, which is wild.
That's crazy.
Here, Steve, there's a question right here. Hand to this while I fix this.
Okay. Are there any formal studies being done down south pertaining to bear trauma? There's nothing that I'm aware of currently specifically on that subject. There have been numerous studies when we talk about like live release after a tournament. Actually, Todd Driscoll, who's the biologist for Toledo Bend, and Sam Rayburn for Texas Parks and Wildlife, he's done some really great tracking studies where they tag the fish with radio tags and track them. There's been mortality studies done for the last 20 years, 25 years. On tournament release fish, but barotrauma specifically. And if we get into the subject of like, how should you fizz a fish? Should you use weights? Those kind of things. There's nothing that's currently going on that's on my radar. Thanks for the question, Lucas.
Am I back?
You're back, bud.
Whew, that was weird. So nothing went out in my soundboard.
No problem. We handle it. You can get rid of that map. Quit showing everybody the details. Man, if I was fishing Bassmaster this week.
Yeah. Oh, and it's going to be cut off. I bet you that'll get circulated
tomorrow. Oh, why wouldn't it? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You're just breaking all the rules on this Serious Angler podcast.
Hey, I didn't realize till we were getting on here when I opened up these links. That's what that was. Okay. We're good.
We're good.
I know there's some guys that listen to this show that I'm sure it'll be maybe Sunday we'll get a text of like, hey, thanks, dude.
No, I think at this point they got a game plan.
I'm sure. I'd hope anyway. They had their last.
If you're sitting right now listening to Serious Angler and going, I've got a waypoint now, I'm going to rock them. Yeah, you were in trouble. You were in trouble. No. There's too many good guys out there, man. They are hammers. Especially these young guys. They've got this figured out. Okay. I want to tell you about the other thing we did while we're at Toledo Bend, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Okay, I sent you a link to a Major League Fishing article.
Yes,
because I've got pictures on there. I want to talk about it. So, like I said, at a lot of our events, we do conservation projects. And for this event, well, in the lead up to events, when I'm sharing data with the state agencies and we're discussing minimum weights and things like that, I typically ask them about local reservoirs and are there issues going on? Can we help with anything? And we have a really great partner in Minn Kota that has allowed us to do these habitat restoration projects. And in talking to Todd Driscoll about what we were going to be competing at Toledo Bend, about what was going on in his district, he's kind of got that Southeast Texas Jasper district. There's Sam Rayburn Reservoir right down the road. And what a lucky dude to be managing both of those fisheries. But we started talking about Sam Rayburn and the fact that we do have an MLF event the following week at the Rayburn Tackle Warehouse event. And he started telling me about the study he did looking at the number of tournaments on Sam Rayburn. And he said that there were 300 tournaments a year is what Sam Rayburn averages. And those that takes into account, you know, your if it's a weekend or like a Thursday or Wednesday night event, there's still 20 boats on a Rayburn. So even like the small local, you know, working man tournament is a fairly large event. But he said the majority of those events happen out of what's called Umphrey Family Pavilion. Have you ever been there, Bailey?
No, I have not.
Okay, super cool. So at the dam on Rayburn, you've got this area. If you go back to my Toledo Bend map real quick, we can actually look at the park.
So actually, I got to pull the link because I exited out of it.
Oh, don't worry about it. It don't matter. It's this really cool park, right? At the dam, there's this island, and then there's one little cove, and the rest of it's just the abyss, right? But this Umphrey Park has like a big pavilion, a stage area, has a couple boat docks, and the majority of tournaments have been going out at Umphrey Park. And what that means is that every week, or at least 300 times a year, fish are being released at Umphrey Park. And when they're released from the boat dock, they can take a right and they can go into the creek channel. They can go straight out across the channel to the island, or they can take a left and now they're in the abyss until they hit the dam and then they're running the riprap of the dam. So I started talking to Todd about it and the number of fish that he projects that are released in that area. And I told him that we really want to do a Minn Kota habitat restoration around Umphrey Park. Because we know that whenever fish are released after a tournament, they stay within a half a mile for a couple weeks and then maybe extend out to a mile. And that's about as far as they go for 6 months to a year. So we know that these fish are staying local, but there's not a lot of habitat because there's so much deep water. So what we did, we partnered with Minn Kota, of course, in Kubota, and we bought a bunch of mossback fish habitat. Mossback fish habitat is products that are made with recycled PVC. And the really cool part about PVC, as long as it's a rigid plastic, it doesn't have like plasticizers or things like that that could leach out. Plasticizers are what makes plastics really flexible because they're rigid and recycled. It's pretty environmentally friendly. And Mossback does a great job about, you know, sending really clean plastic that is easy to assemble. So if we scroll down just a little bit, you can see some of the product that we built. And what we designed, going to try to find a picture that kind of highlights it. There's a cool write-up that I did. Yeah, there you go, buddy. Keep going down. There's an actual photo gallery that's going to happen eventually. There we go.
Can you pull this up?
Sure. We can look through them. Just keep clicking through it, and I'll just talk. You're great. Making podcast history here. So you see there, we're building what Mossback calls a conservation cube. It's well known that cubes are the number one type of artificial habitat because they give you like shade edges as well as density within it to attract bait fish. And I do have Britt Chapman's there, Greg Vinson's there. So we're building these cubes, and you see the mossbacks, they go in with all these limbs. They create a lot of density. So what we did was we paired two 60-inch cubes next to each other, and then we put four trees around it, and we dropped those in four sites just outside of Umphrey Park.
It's so handy, man.
There's me. Look, I'm even using a tool. I'm using a screwdriver. Yeah. I was actually there.
Did you pose? Be honest, did you pose for this one?
No, probably not. Because usually whenever we get to these projects, I do like a demo, like a how to build it. So that's probably during that demo. Like, I'm showing them how to do it. There's me telling Britt Chapman, like, hey, yeah, I'm watching the guys. They're really catching them today. Cliff Crochet, 11 pounder.
I just picture this being so memeable of like, Brent, now you did this all wrong. You could do a bunch of stuff. That's pretty funny. That's cool.
There's Todd Driscoll. That's the head of biologist for Rayburn and Toledo Bend. So you see, there's the product. It's all textured. You can keep going, Bailey. It's cool. It's all textured, recycled PVC. So when it goes in the water, it quickly starts to grow algae on it, or biofilm as we call it. And that's what feeds little bitty fish and creates that microenvironment. So you see, we worked on this for about 4 hours putting these together. And then we're going to get to the cool part really quickly, I promise you.
Oh, my gosh.
What happened, Bailey? Did your mouse die now? Computer froze. This is a professional show you run. It's all that mobile equipment. You know, Bailey, if you would take your kayak career as literal as you take this this podcast, there's no telling where you could go.
Am I back?
You're back, buddy.
Dude, I don't know. I think it's got to be the cold. Because
it's the cold. You're freezing. Get me to the barge. We're almost there. We're halfway there. See the big barge. So there's the new Texas Parks and Wildlife barge, hydraulic barge going in the water. Keep going. There's me. I got to drive that little Kubota tractor. Yeah. See, I'm moving cinder blocks. Look, I'm driving the tractor.
Getting after it.
Yeah, Kubota actually, Kubota had one of their stores send that out just for us to use to support the project. Yeah, they're a great partner for this.
You guys hogging the ramp.
Oh, yeah. It's a four lane ramp. We got two lanes shut down. There was a tournament that went out that morning out of that. There's some of the trees that we were installing. That's the John Godwin crappie tower. So we put two of the cubes, then we put four trees. And this is a hydraulic dump bed. So they go out to the spot. They've got it marked with a buoy. They put a GPS location, and they press a button, and it just dumps it out. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
That is incredible. And so how many trips does this usually take for you guys taking stuff out there?
On this one, it was 20 trips. Because we could put two of the cubes are huge. They're 60 inches tall. Each one of those limbs is 60 inches long. So you start building a footprint of what that actually is. It's huge. And the cool part about the mossback is it's that V shape. So this is upside down right now. You flip it right back over. Whenever it goes out, it flips over. But it's a V shape. So like, we have some video where I actually put a mossback in the Berkeley Lab tank and would like throw baits through it and try to catch them. And I couldn't catch them. So it's just got this really unique design that reflects lures up. So here's the cool part. We put these out during the Toledo Bend event on day one. I drive back home. I go to actually a fisheries conference. And then our Tackle Warehouse Invitational crew, they go and they fish at Rayburn. And we had three fish over 11 pounds that were caught and weighed in, released at Umphrey Park, right where we had just put the habitat. So we can for sure talk about how those fish are going to have the ability to recover forage successfully, have habitat there, build a new home range if they desire, or once they recover, swim to wherever the next area is that they're going to build their home range. So it was a very successful project. Unbelievable support by Minn Kota and Kubota. Great product by Mossback. You know, we start talking about these projects across the country. A habitat restoration is the number one thing we can do. We're not building new reservoirs. If we stock fish, they're consumed fairly quickly unless there's abundant habitat. If there's abundant habitat, there's typically success from reproduction. Habitat's being lost just due to the age of our timber and things like that. And, you know, vegetation is so seasonal and complicated. So artificial habitat projects like this, I mean, that's the number one way, the industry can support anglers and anglers can support biologists and we can all work together to build fisheries. It's something, you know, it's a common ground that we can come to that we all agree will improve our fisheries. Bailey's on the struggle bus. He's getting frustrated. I've known Bailey a long time.
Right, back.
You're back. I've known Bailey a long time. Dude. Look, that look.
It's like three times now. Soundboard. It actually is quite cold on this thing, so we might wrap this thing up here in a second before they
yeah
any permanent damage on this thing. But dude, I was trying to say, and the thing was of course muted. I really want to get myself to one of these deals and try to help out with one. I know we have some offline discussions going, but I'm looking forward to hearing about how this year's are going to go and the ones coming up.
I've got four really cool projects coming up. Number one, the next one I'll be at is during Red Crest, where the guys are fishing Lay Lake. I'll be on Logan Martin, and we'll be putting out fish habitat on Logan Martin. Then immediately after the Classic, I'm going to be on Lake Eufaula in Oklahoma, in Eufaula Cove, building something very similar to what we did at Sam Rayburn. That's Eufaula Cove has really become a popular tournament release site. So we're going to build a bass recovery zone throughout there. We've partnered with Oklahoma Department of Wildlife and Conservation, Mossback, of course, Minn Kota, and Hummingbird to put that project together. And Oklahoma themselves, they purchased Mossback fish habitat, and they're also building some stuff. The city of Eufaula, Oklahoma, has been involved. I mean, I think the budget for this project is going to be somewhere around $60,000 by the time we're done with it. So it's a major habitat project. So we have Red Crest, we have Eufaula, Oklahoma. Our guys are at Dale Hollow. We just confirmed a project with the Tennessee DNR there. So we'll be in Tennessee. And then I've got one more project that we're working on whenever our guys visit the Chowan River. We're going to do something cool with the Chowan River, I think.
Oh, heck yeah. That'd be freaking sweet.
It's nerdy cool. It's nerdy cool. A lot of water quality stuff. And the cool part about Chowan, and maybe we can talk about the schedule and things like that later, but cool part about the Chowan is its tidal. So you got saltwater inflow. That means on drought years, you have saltwater increasing into shallow water. You also have timber that continuously flows down the river. So you have an abundance of habitat, but sometimes the water quality can't let fish live. And maybe they can live, but they can't reproduce. And so we have to start figuring out how to protect rivers like that a little better.
Yeah, I'm intrigued with that, like learning about how I think that could be a show in itself, getting you back on talking about tidal fisheries and how that alone affects these fish.
I mean, truthfully, that's a subject that I'm still learning. It's that is complex. It's very complex.
It's probably a lot of theory still versus some of the studies we've been able to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of tracking studies where we look at fish movement. There's a couple where we look at the removal of fish from tidal waters and what do they do when they're released back upstream and how many of those fish literally leave, go coastal, and then come back up somewhere else using an estuary or a high salinity area. It's unbelievable. Yeah, so I don't know that I'm the expert on that, but I'm still learning it. And the cool part about the Major League Fishing gig is, when would I have had the opportunity to even know what the Chilean River was?
Right. I never heard of it until it was on schedule this year, to be honest.
Well, so I heard about it when we were at Red Crest last year at Lake Norman. And we started chatting with the crew about where could we go within the state to like put on a really big fish tournament. And this is the area that they recommended, the state biologist.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
We all started there.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
That's very freaking cool. Sweet, man. Using them as a resource of like, hey, we need a new event.
Yeah. I mean, we could do a show about how events are put together too. Cause it's pretty unbelievable. All the complexities that go into building a schedule and then trying to produce a TV show on top of that. Then a guy like me, that's like, let's do habitat work. And then you incorporate tourism in it as well. And it's a complex deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to, that's a whole show right there. Man, appreciate you a ton for this information. Like, this is freaking sweet. There's been a couple shows where I've gone back a little bit and dug out some nuggets, but this is probably the show that I'll go back and rewatch.
Entirely. You need to blur. We need a filter. This will be heavily edited. It will actually just be Bailey saying hello, me saying goodbye.
That's right. That'll be it. Let me put on pause. This is probably going to be quite a shared around video for what was shown on this thing.
Well, I have them for every event. So if there's an event that happens later this year that you are interested in, or if we want to break them all down, I don't care. I love this stuff. We provide it to the state agencies because it makes better fisheries. But at the end of the day, those fisheries are owned by the public, right? That's all our resource.
Right. That's awesome, dude. I'll keep up with this, man. And obviously, you know, we're big fans of you and what you guys are doing, and want to be help any way that we possibly can. But if there's people watching this, is it one possible, if so, where, if someone that literally is sitting on this, watching this live stream, wants to assist or be of any benefit to your program, what you got going on?
Absolutely. The best way right now is to, and it sounds so corny, go to MLF.com, become a member. It's free membership. But it allows me to have access to your email address so that I go to our team and I say, hey, I'm putting a habitat project together at Logan Martin and I need volunteers. And the first place they go is that email membership. And they say, let's send an email to everybody within 50 miles of the reservoir. And so you would get an email that explains to you what we're doing, where we're doing it, how you can volunteer. And then, Minn Kota, as you know, they are a big supporter of our habitat projects, and they're willing to get some swag to those volunteers and make it worth your time for coming and volunteering. You also get time with professional anglers. So in the past, KVD he's probably been the angler that's came to the most projects, or Gary Klein. Gary Klein comes to a lot because he's involved with Fisheries Management Division as a director. So Klein, Kevin, we have like Michael Neal's kind of to a bunch. So you'll get time like you've never had before with the biologist that manages the reservoir, the anglers that compete on the reservoir, and then there's not that many people there. You know, there might be, let's say, 12 of us at the Habitat Project. So it's the perfect time if you do want to volunteer and you do want to improve your fishery and you want to spend time with professional anglers and get to know your biologist, it's the perfect time.
You know what would be really cool is for your next project is if we got somebody that is a follower or listener of Serious Angler, if you guys go, if you're in the area, however, go and be a volunteer. Yep. One, obviously, it sounds cool that you get some Minn Kota swag because Hummingbird Minn Kota definitely, they know the game when it comes to swag. We'll hook you up on the Serious Angler side. We'll get you some Blackfish gear, Omnia gift cards, you guys go and help Steve out. But the caveat is you got to come with Steve and join us on the podcast and give your perspective of volunteering. Right. And then we should get a pro and kind of have the full POV of these events.
Sign me up. I've got Logan Martin, Lake Eufaula, something whenever we're around Dale Hollow, and something whenever we're in North Carolina, for sure. I've got those cooking. So I usually do them the first or second day of every event. So it is a Tuesday or Wednesday is what I try to do. I think the Eufaula date will be the Monday following the Classic. Just logistically, we have a lot of people traveling in and out at that time. So that looks like a good opportunity. And of course, Red Crest is the Monday following Red Crest out at Logan Martin.
And okay, when we get closer to these, we get some solid dates. We'll throw them up on our social. We'll talk about our podcast, and we'll get some people fired up and getting out there.
That sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. And I will have a habitat restoration experience at Red Crest. So I've got a 20x40 area where I'm going to set up a complete habitat project. And if you come to the Red Crest Outdoor Expo, you can walk through the booth and feel and see what the fish are going to have it's going to Logan Martin after we're done.
That's freaking sick.
Yeah. I want you to feel it. I want you to think about where fish are going to be on the habitat, how they're going to use it. And I want to think about how your baits are going to move through it.
I want to be the fish.
And then I want you to help me put it out. And then after we're done putting it out, I want you to go smash them. And we've got some really cool videos of, a year later, Kevin fished one of our habitat projects. He's got an awesome video on the MLF website. I've actually got some stuff on my personal social media of within 5 minutes catching fish over 5 pounds off the habitat.
I want to get some for we'll call it a private pond in New York. It'll definitely not go to the Finger Lakes, I promise.
Promise. Hell, the Finger Lakes, if you just got a good cinder block, it'd probably do a lot.
Yeah, no kidding. They don't let us put anything, but the homeowners are allowed to put weed mats. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. That's another show.
It is. We'll just put them on blast. That's what we'll do. dude, I'm serious, though. If someone is watching or listening to the show that is interested, obviously you can go out and, like Steve mentioned, become a member, things like that. Steve, would they also be able to just simply DM you or DM us if they wanted to
get involved? Yeah, DM you, DM me, email me, steven.barden@majorleaguefishing.com. If you can spell all that out, I'll reply.
I'll put it down in the description for everybody too. That way it's easy. You just go in the notes, copy paste. We're in a copy paste world. But I'm serious. I will. I'll hook them up with some Blackfish gear, Omni Fishing gift cards. Like, we'll get them some stuff from our sponsor, some X2 swag. And then you guys can get on the podcast. So highly encourage you guys to reach out to Steve, get involved in that. It looks like a super freaking cool experience, man.
And if you can't volunteer at one of ours, but you have like an angler group, a local club, and you're interested in how do I get something like this to happen at my local reservoir, send me an email too. I can give you some advice on that. There's no telling. Maybe I will just show up with a bunch of habitat and a couple of anglers, and we'll just do it outside of the tour.
There you go. That's freaking sweet, man. Well, keep leading the industry, dude. It's cool to keep along with what you're doing and be involved in a few different ways. One, obviously, as a friend here on the show, but then also behind the scenes with work, get to be relatively involved with you on it and just kind of keep up with what you're doing. And it's awesome, man. It's really cool.
You guys should see Bailey at work. You get on conference calls and he's there. His audio works about as well as he's doing this podcast.
My audio works. That's the best part.
Bailey, here's the problem. When Andy's not here, I have to pick on you.
I know. You got to. Somebody's got to. It's okay. Dang,
we need Andy back.
My life is everyone's expense. That's what my dad told me when I was growing up.
No, we need Andrew back. Hopefully he gets feeling better.
Yeah.
Keep putting out great content. I loved last night's episode. Everything you guys do is awesome.
Appreciate it, buddy. You are always welcome on the show. You know that. You always got a seat. And Man, I'm bummed I'm not gonna make it to Red Crest, but we'll figure out a way to bump into you this year.
Absolutely. And the rest of this week, I'm going to our Texas Chapter American Fisheries Conference. All of our state biologists and any fisheries student from the state of Texas is going to meet, and I become the president of that organization. And
dang, congratulations.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you so much.
That's awesome.
Doing big things, brother. Last thing.
Yeah.
I want to formally invite you and Andrew to San Antonio in August of 2025. For the third ever Black Bass Summit. It happens every 25 years. So this is the third time ever. We're going to have a Black Bass Summit. We're going to bring all the biologists. We're going to have a podcast area. We're going to have professional anglers. And we're going to talk about the history of fisheries management, current fisheries management, how to create a better future, and then how to create partnerships. We're going to do it over 4 days in San Antonio. I want you and Andrew to come.
Are we allowed to put our own state on blast and tell them they have to attend?
They will have an invite because at the same time, the Parent Society of American Fisheries is hosting their annual meeting across the street, across the river. Technically, it's on the river. So across the Riverwalk, they're holding their annual meeting in conjunction. So I'll be representing Texas as our president at that meeting. And I am part of the planning committee for Black Bass 2025. So they'll be there.
2025, consider us in, man. We'll be there.
I'm writing it down. San Antonio.
I'm looking at my schedule. I think I'm clear. We'll be all right.
It's August. That's a tough time for Andy to get off, but he's just going to have to. We'll have to book him as a guide.
If he can't, Deacon will fill in. We'll figure it out. One way or another, we'll be there.
We need everybody there. We need it to be big. We need to be big. We can do live podcast. I can just line up biologists and let you knock them down.
We got like a year and a half to plan this thing out, so let's get cracking.
Love it, brother. Let's do it. Thank you so much.
All right, buddy. Appreciate you as always, and we'll be talking to you real soon.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, man. We'll see you. Well, there you have it, folks. Mr. Stephen Barden, a lot to unpack in that show. A lot of really, really cool freaking information. I hope you guys learned from Steve. As always, I do every time I speak to him, or at least get him on the show. Glad to call him a friend, but also he's definitely one that I love to pick the brain of because he's just full of knowledge. But folks, hope you guys enjoy that episode. Hopefully we'll get old Capitan back on the show next week and he's feeling better. Trying to mention, I have one more thing. Here I go. I'm like the soundboard right now. I'm glitching out. There's a bunch of sales going on at Omnia Fishing. And of course, all of our links down to the discount codes and everything like that are always in the show descriptions. And then next Monday night is going to be the Lake Fork Fantasy Fishing Show. So if you guys tuned in last night, or if you're looking to tune in for a Fantasy Fishing live show, we're going to be going live Monday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern. Then we'll go live once again, of course, a week from tonight, Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern. So you guys are getting lucky with a couple live streams a week now. Now that it's fantasy fishing season, so the weeks of events, we're going to have multiple live streams. But throughout the rest of this week, we'll have a kayak fishing weekly show as well as the Lure Lab dropping on Saturday. So you guys have more content coming your way. I have the tournament this weekend, so I'll keep you guys updated. If you're not following me on social personally, if not, you guys will figure out how it goes early next week. But folks, appreciate you guys. As always, if you're listening on MP3, please leave us a rating and review, especially on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. That helps us out big time with being shown more, which allows more people to listen to the amazing people we have in our industry, like Steven, who can teach a lot and really bring more positive benefit to our sport. So please, if you can, do so. Folks, appreciate y'all. We'll see you on the next one.
Well, that was an awesome show. Hope you guys enjoyed it. If you can and your app allows it, please leave us a rating and review. It really helps us get seen more, which allows us to access more time and more variables to be able to bring to the show to make it better for you guys. So hope you enjoyed it. And if you did and you liked some of the things we talked about in this episode and want to check out our show partners, all of that is in every single show description. You can click down there. It's got all of our discount codes, all of our links to our show partners, where you guys can go and support the people that support this show and help us make this show happen. And of course, this show does not happen without you guys. You guys know we appreciate you. You're the Serious Angler fam. You're the reason we're here. Appreciate y'all, and we'll see y'all on the next one.